I've certainly done this where even a good CPD you'll go to and then you'll leave and maybe you won't get the right case, you won't quite have the right tool, the right confidence, and you won't implement it, even though you've got the knowledge. The knowledge isn't everything.
Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and this week we sit down with a graduate. Of course, we're aimed at students and graduates and helping students and graduates, and that's exactly what Dan Marinovsky does himself. Dan and Alex Kominski have started the General Dental Residency, and their aim and their purpose is to help dental students and graduates as well. So it's, of course, a no-brainer to have Daniel on and to interview him and get his insights. Dan is well known as dentist.dan on Instagram, and he's producing some of the most amazing work for someone who's only been a little over a year out of dental school. The level of content Dan is posting is incredible, and I'm really impressed. It's great to hear his story of how he got to this, how he became so passionate, and his attitude to getting better and how he did it. We talk about how he got into dentistry, we talk about his first job mentoring, and we get some insights on his journey through CPD courses and the frustrations he had from this. Frustrations a lot of us have experienced, and something that himself and Alex are trying to change with GDR. This is a fascinating chat with someone who's only a year and a bit out of university. It's really impressive. Thanks for joining us, Daniel. Now, of course, I want to say thank you to our sponsors. We've got BOQ Specialist, Restoring Excellence, and Prime Practice with us today. They make all of this possible. And make sure you check out cpdjunkie.com.au to find your next CPD course. It's a comprehensive listing, one place, all of the courses, all of your options. Make an account to stay in the loop. All right, enjoy the chat with Daniel Marinovsky. Being a student is pretty tough. The stresses of exams, patient care, and everyday life is enough without having financial stress as well. BOQ Specialist recognizes this. They offer a student package if you're in your last 2 years of dentistry. It's a pretty good package. Actually, I used it myself. They recognize that you don't have much of an income now, but that'll change. They'll give you a credit card and they'll give you an overdraft. And the overdraft, you don't even have to pay back until halfway through your first year after graduation. Now, I'm not recommending you go and spend this money on anything, but if you need it to buy loops or if you need it to get through that final year, they really do have your back. And I know I struggled in that last year financially, and it really helped. So thank you to BOQ Specialists supporting me in my final year for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast. Welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm David Keir, and this episode I have Dan Marinovsky. How are you tonight, Dan?
Hey, I'm doing very well. Thanks so much for having me on. Like I said before, I'm still not sure why exactly you've called me on to here, but it is an absolute honor as a big podcast fan to make a debut appearance. So thank you so much.
Welcome, Dan. And I thought you might say something like that, and I want you to know, and I think the listeners know that, Dan, you have a lot to give, and I think your story is going to be fascinating. That's because when I was a student, I remember really wanting to know how people were going early on, because what's actually important is kind of the next step. And you're a new graduate, you've done a lot in your first year, you're going into your second. And not only a lot in dentistry, you've done a lot outside for dentists in your courses and things that you're organizing. So it's a pleasure to have you on. And I want to know, you make it look easy. Is it easy to juggle all those hats?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for those kind words there, David. Is it easy? I don't think anything in life that's good is easy, unfortunately. So I can't claim that it's easy. It's a lot of hard work, I think, and, you know, not to complain or anything, but I think I'm super, super fortunate and lucky to be where I am. But there is a lot of hard work that goes into, I guess, trying to be your best every day, really.
Yeah. And I guess that's a bit of a lead into that, because there's no doubt I see what you're doing with the graduate dental residency. And but at the same time, you're putting a lot of content up on social media and you're doing beautiful work early on. Work, honestly, that is much nicer than mine. I'm 3 years out, you're 1 year out, and it's very impressive. We're going to get into all of that, and it's going to be really exciting to find out how you've got to where you are already and where you're going in the future. But let's go back. Where did you grow up? Where are you from?
Yeah, good question. So I guess, I was born in Perth, Surprisingly, I spent all of 6 months there as a child. At the time, my parents, they were actually studying. So my dad, he was, my heritage is Russian. So that they'd migrated. And this is going back, obviously, about 20, 25 years ago. They'd just migrated and he was in Perth, actually taking his undergraduate degree again. So he was retraining to become a vet. And
had he already trained?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
That must have been tough.
I mean, it was. And I think that like any people that migrate, you know, I think the story is really common and shared between them in that, you know, they come with nothing and you know, start life all over again. So for them, it was certainly difficult not having any help, you know, here around. And super, super proud of my parents for sort of coming as far as they had in those circumstances. Especially when we moved out to Perth, at least in Melbourne, you know, we had some family, some friends, but when it came to study time, we were really all alone there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that must have been hard. He must have really loved vet science or being a vet to re-study it. Did he ever talk about perhaps going in a different path?
Yes, and it's funny you mentioned that because, you know, maybe to skip ahead a little bit, but I really do feel that part of the reason that, you know, I became a dentist is because he regrets that he didn't become a dentist in Australia. And then he pushed that onto me by sort of pushing me in that direction.
Yeah, vet's a pretty hard thing, you know, compared to dentistry, perhaps it's a hard thing to succeed in, but it's a lot of work to get there as well. So he was an influence on you for dentistry. Did you have that innately as well?
That's a good question. I mean, I think my story is very typical in that I was one of those kids that grew up thinking they'd become a doctor and go and do medicine. And, you know, I think partly it was definitely parental influence. I think a lot of people probably with ethnic parents can relate to that. But in my case, it was a little bit of childhood health problems. You know, I had quite severe asthma as a kid. So, yeah, I guess spending a bit of time at, you know, Royal Children's and just in that sort of hospital medical environment. And then later on in life too, you know, I had an injury with my hip and, you know, in and out of those sorts of places did sort of steer me in that direction. But ultimately, I think it was definitely a bit of parental influence and common sense that kicked in to steer me to dentistry in the end there.
Was it a good choice?
Oh, time will tell. Ask me again in 10 years.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. You're only 1 year in. You can't make that call.
That's right. So, that's right. Yeah.
Do you remember the day that you went from wanting to go down that medical path into the dentistry path? And why was it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tricky question to answer. You know, I can definitely say that when I did graduate from high school and it came to that time where you had to put your preferences in, I remember that it was the night before and I was still tossing up my list because, you know, although I was applying interstate also, you know, I was young for my year. I was finishing high school at 17. So, you know, I don't think I was quite mature enough, quite ready to leave home per se, or at least leave the state. So when it came to the preference list, the Victorian preference list was really quite important for me. And at the very last minute, I did put medicine first. You know, funnily enough, I had an interview there at Monash Medicine in Melbourne. But God knows how they gave me the interview because I was absolutely, absolutely shocking at the UMAT. And I'm sure lots of people who were like me, the medical hopefuls, went through similar sort of experiences. But look, I ended up with an offer to medicine up in James Cook University, up north. And I wasn't sure what to do. I wasn't ready to move interstate. You know, I felt that I was a bit young. And what I did was I deferred the offer. So this was a long story to answer your question because what happened at the end was I finished my first year of dental school and I still had that offer that had been deferred. And for a good few weeks over the break, I was actually traveling at the time. I honestly still considered going back and actually, you know, giving up dentistry and making the switch. And it was a hard decision for me because, you know, very much so, I still felt that medicine was the career pathway for me. And I couldn't even tell you why. It was just this idea in my head ever since I was a child, you know, nothing too rational. And I think part of that also was that I was one of those, you know, maybe one of those people that studied really hard in high school and sort of always had the idea that, you know, once you get to uni, you're there, you've made it, it's all good. And, you know, that really flipped a switch in me because I, to be honest, I virtually almost failed in my first year of dental school.
Yeah. So what kept you in dental school?
Wow. Okay. Oh, I got to have a think about that. You know, I think that it's the general notion for me of, you know, if you do something, then do it right, put all your effort into it and see it out. And a lot of that, I think, was given to me, you know, through my parents and their mindset having migrated to Australia, that you don't, I guess, don't be a quitter. So, you know, I wish I could tell you it was some innate passionate spark that was born out of, you know, some incredible experience. But honestly, I think it was just the drive to see something out and see where it led to. And that's not to say that I didn't like what I was doing. I think that very much so, I just didn't know what I was in for. And, you know, for me, that's something I'm really passionate about now is I guess, trying to have dental students understand what they're in for, because I certainly had no idea what dentistry was about. I'm still finding out.
Exactly, aren't we all? But that's a really common thread that people, a couple of these things are common threads actually. I'm actually sometimes a bit surprised how many people, you know, medicine first and they end up in dentistry and then they're not really sure about dentistry and then they become the best dentists in the world almost. So certain people I've talked to, it's amazing. And I guess we don't know our path until we've kind of gone down that path. And it depends.
I was going to say, we should run a study on that because I think you're right. As so many people like that, it's interesting, isn't it?
I remember the dentist I worked for many years as an assistant. So I was one of the rare ones. I actually had a lot of experience as an assistant before I became a dentist. So I kind of knew what I was getting into in that kind of private practice dental small business field. But he would always say the best dentists now for him were always the bottom third of the class. The top third, most of them had either left dentistry or burnt out or anything, all these, you know, it wasn't about how you went in dental school. It wasn't about how much you loved it then. You find your passion, you grow through that. And I think that's important for students and graduates to hear as well. If they're not entirely sure, it doesn't mean they're not going to find it and love it, or perhaps maybe they will change. That's fine.
I was going to say, yeah, that's for sure. I mean, I think everyone's on their own journey and a part of it, you know, a lot of it I think is really just giving something time and energy. You know, if you want to be able to know and find out if something is for you, you really need to see it out, I think, to truly understand. And, you know, as a side note, I was traveling recently. It was my first time traveling solo. Which was a really great experience, really interesting. And one of the things that shocked me was the amount of people you see traveling who are traveling to find themselves, who feel quite lost, you know, without direction. They're not sure what their career path looks like. They're not sure what they're meant to do in life. And part of me wonders if just throwing yourself into something and committing, going all in, you know, whether that's the answer as opposed to, you know, wondering and waiting for it to come to you.
Yeah, I think that resonates a lot. Both sides of that story resonate a lot. If you throw yourself in and you just get stuck into it, I don't think we have one path. I think you'd be great as a doctor. You'd be great as probably an engineer as well. And it's because you chase difficulty, you pursue that path, and that's fine. You'll be good no matter where you are. But if you don't choose, you'll never be good at anything. But at the same time, the talk about travel, I did my undergrad. So I did a postgrad, and my undergrad, I took 2 years off. It was meant to be 1 year, it became two, because I was quite burnt out. And that travel actually did allow me to find out that I was definitely sure I wanted to come back and put the effort into dentistry. So for me, travel, solidified a view I already had. Tell me about that travel, particularly solo travel. That's a really cool experience.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess it's always something I'd wanted to try for no particular reason other than to experience it, because, you know, a lot of people talk about it. And the incredible thing was the amount of people that you meet on a trip like that. You know, I say it was solo traveling, but it's really a misnomer, because I think that solo traveling is the best way to meet people. And just really putting yourself, I guess, out of your comfort zone to put yourself out there and meet people. That's what I found most fascinating, because there's no easier place to make a friend, but it still requires that effort, that thought. You know, it's something as simple as asking someone what book they're reading. And, you know, you'd go from, you know, asking the person in the bunk bed next to you. Actually, a funny story on that. I was staying in hostels, you know, on this trip, because it's the best place to meet people and to have a good time. But at the same time, and I'm sure a lot of new graduates might empathize with me, but, you know, once you graduate, you start earning some money. And, you know, you think, you know, it'd be fun to splash out on something wild. You always imagine, I always did in my head. And, you know, for example, I always told myself that once I graduate, I would spend all my money, my first paycheck, on my mom, which I did. It took me a few months, but I got around to it.
Yeah. Good. That's cool.
But what happened was, in that process, is I decided to sign up to a credit card. All my friends were signing up to credit cards. And they were telling me, you got to sign up. This is the best way you get frequent flyer points. It's great. So I did that. I did a bit of research, looked into it. I signed up for a card. I met the minimum spending requirement. I think you know a little bit sort of how these things work. And I had a bunch of points. So I was like, what better way to use them than by living the dentist life and trying out a business class flight? So I spent.
It is the best way to use your points. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's what they say. And so, not that I could afford it, you know, that I would ever spend my actual money on it. but I spent every point I had on this one-way flight to Vietnam. And the funny thing was, I hadn't booked a return until I actually went on that first flight. I booked my return when I was there, because I was a bit unsure how long I wanted to go away for. It felt like a bit of an escape for me. So here I was, flying business class, best experience of my life, and I walked straight off the plane into my hostel for $4 a night.
Yeah, that's awesome. what a contradiction, I guess. But yeah, I guess as you travel through hostels, you really learn a lot about how to save money, and yeah. It's good fun. It's definitely good fun. So, you did that after graduation.
Yeah. So, this was actually 1 year after graduation. And, you know, it's a big regret I had. And I tell a lot of dental students this is go run away once you graduate. I think that, you know, there's often this sort of hysteria. And I certainly was a part of that when I graduated, where, you know, your friends are getting jobs. It's coming to that time of year, October, November, you know, you're seeing that exam results have come through, you've passed, you can breathe a sigh of relief. And all of a sudden, you know, you look around and all of your friends have got jobs, and you're sitting there thinking, well, you know, why don't I have my job yet? And I think that you know, I certainly did get into a bit of a panic, you know, just putting in tons of applications and really stressing without basically realizing that we've really got our whole lifetime to work. And there's certainly no rush to get into it, because once you start, as I'm sure you can agree with me here, it's very difficult to stop and take time off, because a lot of factors come in. You start worrying about your workplace, especially when you're just starting out, your workplace, you know, giving you that time off. You feel bad because you're the new person there. They've just given you this great gratitude of a job that you virtually had to beg them for. And here you are asking for time off. And so it can be very difficult. So, you know, one thing I always tell dental students that I speak to is go, you know, run away as soon as you graduate. You know, if you do have any inkling to take time off to go travel somewhere, there's really no better time and no better opportunity when you don't have those responsibilities yet.
Yeah, for sure. And travel, I'm a massive advocate of travel, and I agree with everything you just said so much. I think one of the hard things when you graduate and then you start working as well is often you start working, you start earning some money, you probably change your lifestyle a little bit, and then taking time off, you don't get paid because you're usually a contractor or in some arrangement where you don't get paid when you're not working, and therefore it costs a hell of a lot to take the time off. even though that's not a real, like, it's not a real thing. It costs you at the start to take time off as well, but it's very hard to step away from that income. So taking a few months or a month or however long you want is, it's a critical step. If it's in your mind, it won't go out of your mind. So I think you should do it as well. So you did this and it was a year after, but you were talking a really good point about getting a job and not stressing too much, not getting the wrong job perhaps. How did you go with finding a job?
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting because I think I got really lucky, to be honest. When it came to finding a job, I found it very difficult. You know, I'll be honest with you. I put in over 80 applications, 80 job applications. And, you know, that takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, especially when you're trying to actually customize your resume to sort of suit the job and that sort of thing. And I just remember I would get a phone call and, you know, my hit rate, it wasn't that great. I think out of those 80 applications, I had about 8 of them call me. So about 10%. They rang me up and, you know, I even remember the conversation I had with my current job where I work now. And, you know, I picked up the phone and they go, hi, I'm so-and-so calling from this clinic about your application. And I'd be sitting there scrambling on my laptop, trying to open up to see, you know, which job that was. And it was funny because, you know, in this case, for the job I'm at currently, I quickly opened Seek and I found the listing all while I'm stalling on the phone. I hope my boss isn't listening.
Perfect. Yeah, and, yeah. They will, yeah.
And, yeah. And, you know, I was just asking some general questions and things and I quickly brought up the ad and, you know, in these sorts of ads, there's certain things that they highlight or they put in bold font to sort of catch your eye. And I remember what stood out for me straight away was the word microscopes. And as soon as I saw that and I was on the phone, I said, oh, and of course, you know, the reason why I applied was, you know, I'm so interested in microscopes, which was true at the time. And, you know, funnily enough, if we talk about, you know, why I actually got this job, a lot of it was the fact that I was the first applicant that shared, you know, my boss's love for you know, microscope dentistry and I guess really taking your time to look at things under magnification and do a good job and everything like that. So, you know, that was really what we first bonded over. And to be honest, I think that's why I got the job is because I was so enthusiastic about that part of things.
Yeah, you'd done your research and you had something you could connect on. That's great. It's a bit hard to connect on 80 applications at the same time, but it sounds like you really found a home. Are you getting mentorship in the job you're at?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question because I'm going to ask, you know, you to clarify a little bit because I see more and more often nowadays people talking about mentorship, which I think is fantastic. Because, you know, as a general concept, it's super, super important in one form or another. But the question really is, you know, what form or another? Because it really does come in all sorts of types and flavors. So I think I'm really lucky in that my boss and I feel are really two peas in a pod. So we get along very well and have very similar mindsets. So, you know, whereas some people might thrive on quite a formal mentoring relationship, you know, ours is quite casual. You know, he's very approachable. You know, it's less and less that I call him in, but I still, you know, just yesterday, you know, I was trying to find MB2 in an upper molar and I thought I'd found it, but I wasn't, you know, entirely certain. And so I just get him in to have a look for a minute. And to me, you know, that's the sort of mentorship and oversight that I was after.
Yeah. That's absolutely invaluable. You actually answered that perfectly because I don't think there is one type of mentorship. And I think this keyword mentorship everyone's looking for, I don't think they really know what they're looking for. The big thing that I think is important is that if we're looking for someone to help us, we have to kind of set it up to make it easy for that person to help us. And it doesn't mean it has to be formal. It might be casual. It might be online with someone outside of our area. It might be live. There's so many different ways it can be. And you raise a really good point with that.
That's right. And I think, you know, what you just said about setting up that relationship is really important because from the start, my boss was a big proponent of it. And setting the expectations is key because, you know, at the start, he said, let's meet once a week and we'll stay back late after work and we'll go over, you know, a case together, we'll discuss something. And, you know, it became twice a week, became quite regular, but then life got in the way. What happened was he was opening a new clinic. We were moving buildings and there was a lot of stress and anxiety really associated with that move, as there always is. And overnight, virtually, that sort of mentoring relationship disappeared because he just simply didn't have the time or energy for it. So I think that something that's really important is, A, for people to understand within themselves what they're after, but B, to understand that when it comes to getting a job, you know, and this is not to be cynical or to be off-putting, but people can really have the best of intentions, but sometimes life gets in the way.
Yeah, that's a really good point, is that you've got to remember whoever you're asking for mentorship is giving free time. They're not obviously getting anything. Well, they're getting back the joy that it is to teach. You know what I mean? Like, so you've got to remember that they have a life and that you're asking a lot of that person. You raised some really good points there. Tell us about some of the struggles you've had in this your first year.
Yeah, I think when it comes to struggle, I think the biggest struggle for a new graduate, I mean, I think it's really two things. You know, first thing first, coming out of dental school, I think the first struggle really is just understanding what is dentistry about. And certainly looking back now, and I'm sure that I'm naively saying this now, and in a couple of years' time, I'll be saying the same thing again. But I really had no concept of what, especially private dentistry, was like leaving dental school. I think that the focus there is, and rightly so, it's quite narrow in the sense of, you know, you're learning the basics of each discipline and to become a safe clinician, which is the most important thing. But at the end of the day, when it came to my first day on the job, I had no idea what I was in for. You know, in fact, I walked in virtually on my first day and my boss quite generously had blocked out, you know, the morning. So I was there to observe him, see how the clinic runs, which I thought was great. It was really nice of him. And then in the afternoon, he'd booked one patient in. Great. One patient. I thought, you know, I can handle that. And then I took a look at the notes and I saw what the patient had been booked in for. And they booked a 3-hour appointment. So I thought, okay, great. I'm used to 3-hour appointments as a dental student. That should work fine. And they booked 3 hours for a single visit root canal for an upper molar, a 1/6. And to this day, it remains as the biggest pain point, the biggest challenge that I think I faced this year. And what was great for me was just learning that lesson straight off the bat that it's okay to say no. You know, coming into that job, I felt, you know, it's the first day, you have to be the yes man. You have to say, you know, I can do it. I can get this done. You know, I'm competent. But, you know, even though I may have been those things, it certainly wasn't the time to be extending myself, you know, when I wasn't used to the nurses, the clinic setup, the instruments, everything. We didn't have x-ray holders. I mean, you know, until I came and I asked my boss to order them in, it was one of those clinics where for the periapical films, you'd get the patient to hold it with their finger, which, you know, I wasn't comfortable with. So for me, the biggest challenge at the start definitely was learning to say no, both to, you know, to the clinic, but more so to patients and really setting patient expectations was a big lesson. A big lesson this year for me.
Yeah, that's a great point. I had a case just the other day where there was a patient, long story short, he's had two teeth out and now the third one's sore and the descriptors all sound neurogenic or pathic and nothing's wrong with the tooth and the patient's desperate for this tooth to come out because he thinks it's going to fix the problem. And this was actually a new grad who was seeing the patient and I stepped into second opinion. And it's a really important thing to learn is to be able to say no both to the practice in situ, you know, if you need more time, but to the patients as well. You'll have demanding patients and that can be challenging.
That's right. And I was going to say a big part of that, I think, is saying no to yourself also. And I guess this depends a lot on personality type, but I was certainly someone coming out of dental school who felt like they needed to push on, to push the boundaries, to keep learning, keep expanding at the right rate. And that's a challenge in itself. And probably the second biggest challenge is when to take those baby steps forward and when to say no. And that comes down to saying no to yourself, to saying that, you know, this is outside of my scope, or that I don't think I can achieve the result that the patient reasonably is expecting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a good point. Such a good point. Now, I could go on with that topic for a long time, but let's shift a little bit. You are, in fact, doing some pretty cool work. It looks beautiful on Instagram, and I'm sure there's a lot behind the scenes. But tell us about the journey you've had over, you know, the last year, 18 months, however long, really becoming what you are now. And I'm sure this is going to continue for a very long time. You're going to be a good dentist.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
You are.
That's very kind of you. I think that, you know, if we talk about social media and photography, which I think is what you were sort of leading on to there, it's funny because for me, it's something that started in dental school. So I think this was in fourth year of dental school. And back then, I don't think Instagram dentistry had quite got to the popularity that it is today. I think it was just burgeoning at the time. So I had an account, and I decided that I would start posting pictures and videos and things, and I did. And not to show off, not because I was some, you know, whiz bang who was a natural or anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite. I would always be the person who would stay the longest, finish last, etc. What it was for me, it was just a bit of fun, to be honest, a bit of fun between me and my patients. You know, we would do something, the patient would be happy, or there'd be something interesting, and I'd take a photo of it. And all of the photos, they really started out as photos for the patients. You know, I'm a big advocate of showing patients your work and getting them to appreciate dentistry. And because I think it's one of those fields that people really have no clue, you know, what goes on. I had no clue, obviously, sure. But people have no clue what goes on. And I think that not everyone, but a lot of people, once you're able to show them kind of the power of dentistry and what it looks like physically, they're able to appreciate your work a lot more. So that's what I was doing. I was taking photos, and this was in the public clinics as a student, and I started posting them. And then I moved clinics, and I started at a new rotation, and they had quite a strict social media policy there. So I got a bit scared. They talked about patient confidentiality, breaching privacy, and they didn't name any names, but I got the hint, and I deleted it. I deleted everything. And then I started as a dentist. I started working, and I thought, you know what, maybe it's time to reactivate that account. So I opened it up again. It was back to, you know, I hadn't had any photos posted, and I thought, okay, well, what am I going to do now? And so I thought, how about I post some educational content? I thought, you know, that's what patients want. They don't want to see gross photos of teeth. I'll post photos of how to brush your teeth, why you shouldn't use coconut oil, all that sort of stuff. And I did that for a couple weeks, and then I realized that I hated it. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it. I was forcing myself to come up with some sort of stock pictures and descriptions, and it wasn't for me. It wasn't me. It wasn't what I was passionate about. You know, for those people that do post that sort of content, I think it's incredibly important, but it wasn't for me. So I decided to go back to what I was good at and what I did like, which was posting photos of gory teeth and before and afters and that sort of thing. And again, you know, these photos, they weren't photos that I was staging or that had been precariously set up. These were photos that I had been taking just to show my patients what was going on. And that's sort of where it started. And that's really what it continues to be for the most part. A lot of the photos that I take still, they're really for patients first and foremost. And secondly, they're for me. You know, for social media, that's kind of a third distant. That really, for me, just came about as a place to put these photos and to make myself accountable. But for me, there's nothing better than finishing, you know, a long day and then taking the card from my camera and then just taking those photos, blowing them up onto a massive monitor and just staring at every little imperfection and every little thing that I've done wrong, and just really picking apart, you know, just the decisions, the workflow, all of that. You know, I think it's the only way to properly learn.
You're a sucker for punishment, but because when you do take photos, you realize very quickly that your work's not quite as perfect as you once thought. But I imagine that would be the key driver in your clinical outcomes.
The key driver being
taking the photos and reviewing the photos and learning from each step and each mistake, perhaps, that you notice.
That's right, 100%. And a natural extension of that was, you know, to connect a camera to the microscope that we use at work and to start, you know, recording videos of procedures, taking photos through the microscope, and just really using that as a tool for patient education, but more so for my education,
I think that's a really cool thing. I have not had the opportunity to work with a microscope in that way, but I think one of the things I'd like the most is to be able to photograph very easily and quickly work, and then being able to show, or if your patient's interested, they can watch. Do you have a TV where they can see? Yeah, that's
100%. Really cool. You'd be surprised by the amount of people that like to watch their own procedures. I have patients watching root canals, mums that love watching their kids' fillings. I can't say I've had anyone watch their own extraction, but I'll get back to you when that happens.
Yeah, please put it on social media. No, that's really cool. I actually got the job as a dental assistant when I was 15 because I was asking so many questions. I was really curious, and I would definitely been watching it on the screen if that was an option. We had a question from Dent Academy on Instagram, and it's around your work. And he says your work looks amazing. It's a big compliment. How do you manage your employers and your patients' expectations around time to produce this quality without it, you know, taking too long? Is that something you have any issue with, or do you not find it to be a problem?
That's a really great question. And firstly, thanks again for that massive compliment. A big part of what I do is time. And I am very, very fortunate in that I'm at a clinic where I have massive flexibility with that. So I can be very upfront with that question by saying that I'm very, very slow. Which for me is ironic because, and I'm sure, again, there are many dental students that can empathize with this, but especially towards the end of dental school, you start thinking that you're great. You know, it's that whole, what's that curve called?
The Dunning-Kruger, yeah.
That's right, the Dunning-Kruger. And I think what's interesting about that curve is I think what you have to do is take that curve and map it out, you know, 10 times. Because I think that throughout, you know, our careers, it's going to be a constant loop through that cycle.
Absolutely. Hopefully, the trajectory is up. But
that's
you never
right.
Know.
That's right. Yeah, the average has to be up. But you know, coming to the end of dental school, you know, we thought we were great. We would book appointments shorter. We would work faster. We thought we were hot stuff. And you know, I came out probably still with that mentality. And I think maybe a big part of it was throwing myself into the, you know, the microscope to really see, I guess, every single imperfection in my work, because it is horrifying. And it's happened to me many, many times where I will, well, early on at least, where I would do a treatment with my loops on. And they're regular, I think they're 3x loops. And then I would take a look at it under the microscope and just be horrified at the difference. And, you know, a lot of that is just time and patience and understanding what's good and bad. But for me, very quickly, I realized that I had to slow down. So I'm a very slow clinician, and I'm very fortunate that I'm much slower than I was as a student, which is quite ironic, I think. And I'm very fortunate that I'm in a clinic that supports it. And this is something that I talk to a lot of new graduates when they're or final year dental students when they're looking for a job. And one of the first things I tell them is you need to work out what kind of dentist you want to be before you go and seek out a clinic. And you need to think real hard and long on that, because if your clinic does not support the kind of dentist you want to become, then you'll send yourself down the wrong pathway and end up probably wasting a lot of time. And I've got friends that have gone down that path for sure. You know, in their first year, they've changed jobs, unfortunately, 2-3 times until they found the right fit or still looking. So, you know, time for me was a big factor. So I knew that by seeking out a clinic that was focused on sort of higher quality dentistry and taking your time, that it would give me that luxury, because it is a luxury that not everyone is afforded. And I do realize that. And part of it really is also being in a clinic where potentially, you know, the fees are set in such a way that you can afford to not rush through and try and fit in 10 Fisher sealants in you know, a 20-minute appointment or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I really do agree with that as well. Find, like, because there's different styles of dentistry in a way as well. Some people want to, you know, move fast, care for lots of people by doing that and do work that is up to standard, if you know what I mean. And then some people want to put stains and fissures, and they're two different types of dentistry, and there's two different types of patients who want that. Not everyone wants either or. And I was similar. I found a practice that really did suit me, and I've been there for 3 years. I haven't changed. But I know many people who have found practices that didn't suit them and have had to change. So getting back to the point you said at the start, which is, you know, spend the time to find the right place.
That's right. That's right. And I 100% agree in that. You know, I think especially looking at social media, you could think that this is the right kind of dentistry, but I'm a strong believer that there is no such thing, and we really do need all kinds of dentistry because we have all kinds of patients. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing what you said and focusing on you know, just getting the job done and making sure that patients do have the quality of care they need, but don't necessarily spend, you know, 2 hours in the chair for a quadrant of fillings.
Completely agree. It's so important. You said at the start too that you kind of got into, well, graduated without a real idea of how private practice works. And there's a lot of people begging for me to ask this question. You say you're slow. How slow? What do you mean? How much time do you take for certain things? Is it all right if I ask that? I'll share mine as well.
100%. I'm very open to discuss any and all topics. Yeah. So I think maybe best if you know, give me an example and I'll hit you with a time.
Let's say, all right, so let's do rapid fire. So one filling.
It depends on the
DO,
filling.
A DO on a 5. A DO on a 5.
40 to 50 minutes.
Two fillings? Both posterior.
An hour 10.
Okay. A crown?
Crown is a little bit tricky because it's in our practice, it's sort of a CAD-CAM workflow. So I'm booking 2 hours 40.
Okay. So is that 2 hours for prep and 40 for issue or?
So the timing, it's probably usually about an hour to an hour 15 for prep and scanning. And then probably about 45 minutes for designing and milling. And then about 40 to 50 minutes for bonding.
Yeah, okay. So I do 40 for a filling, 50 to 60 for two, and about an hour 40 for a crown, depending on the material as well. If I do, you know, it, obviously if you're using, if you need a furnace, then it's going to, I do it over lunch. So I tend to do the same amount of timing, but just have my lunch break in the middle. So I think you say you're slow, you're not so bad.
wait, we're forgetting the part where I run late after every appointment.
Yes, exactly. Well, I didn't say that either. So yeah. do you add time to take photos and to document your work, like, or is that include a fair amount of documentation time?
yeah, absolutely not. I think that a lot of people assume that documenting work takes a lot of time, when it really doesn't. I think that it adds maybe a few minutes to my appointments, and I'm very stubborn. As you can ask my nurse today, for example, I had my last patient today. I should post this photograph. Last patient today was booked for an hour and 40 minutes, and that was for two class twos and one occlusal, so three fillings. And I probably spent about half an hour of that appointment. I'm going to say attempting to isolate the teeth. Now, when I say stubborn, you know, not only am I stubborn with photography, but I've become very stubborn with isolating. More so, not because I think that it's the only way you can bond teeth or anything like that, but because I find it's the only way that I can work comfortably. And oftentimes, isolating a tooth will take me just as long as preparing it or filling it. So, you know, when I say slow, I think, you know, a lot of that is that part, really. I think that taking that out of the equation, certainly, you know, you could be saving a lot of time. But the funny story is that I spent half an hour isolating. This was on a 2-8, you know, I isolated from the 2-8 to the 2-3, and the 2-8 was partially erupted. And he was a bigger man with, you know, big, strong muscles and everything. And the poor guy, I virtually tortured him into tolerating this rubber dam. And then 2 minutes into the preparation, it tore. And I gave up.
Oh, that's so good. I've been there, Dan, many times. That's so good. Yeah, that's a lesson learned is isolating a 2-8 that's in someone with a big buckle fat pad is pretty challenging.
very challenging.
Let's start talking a little bit about CPD. It's something that you're very passionate about. I want to hear a bit about your journey with CPD and what you've done and why.
Yeah, and I think the big takeaway from my journey is don't do as I did. I left dental school, and at that point I knew that I liked dentistry. Okay. I knew that I was interested in it. I was passionate about it. I'd started taking photos, documenting things, and I knew I wanted to be good. I just had no idea how to get there. And, you know, being young, I think oftentimes you feel like there's a rush to get there. And I still feel that way. So I'm still young. So, you know, leaving dental school.
You're young enough to restudy medicine and then go and be an engineer and still be in your 30s when you finish. So, no.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you say that, because it was still on my mind. And I'll be honest, when we talk about applying to jobs after finishing, at the top of my priority list was applying for hospital positions in maxillofacial units, because that was still something sitting at the back of my mind.
Has that passed?
It has passed. It has passed. And part of the reason, and I know
where... Is that because your boss is listening?
No, we're dodging your original question for a second here, but I was very lucky in the clinic that I ended up in. It had a bit of a complicated arrangement, but it was two clinics under the one roof. And the other clinic, they almost exclusively did implant surgery and wisdom teeth surgery. So a lot of all-on-four treatment, the anesthetist would be in every week. And that really gave me the opportunity to get a taste for that world. And I quickly realized that I wasn't cut out for it. It was intense. It was butchery. It was long hours. It was grueling. And you know, I did my fair share of those sorts of, well, not the all-on-four cases, but of patients, you know, under general anesthetic, you know, long cases. And, you know, big props to those people who can pull it off. But I quickly realized it wasn't for me. It wasn't for me. I like talking to patients too much. And, you know, for me, that's still my favorite part of the day is, and part of the reason I say I'm slow is I just, and my nurses hate me for it, but I make it a rule that the first 10 minutes of any appointment, I don't talk dentistry with a patient. I just talk about life. And even if they try and make me talk teeth, I'll change the topic. And just talk life, because I think that's you know, it's super important. It's a person first.
Yeah, it's an exceptionally important concept. I'm very, very similar to you in that regard, and I think that's the reason I'm busy. I think you know, make a connection with people, and they see you as a person, they'll come back. It's critical. I'm glad you brought that up. It's interesting you say you've had that experience now with the surgery side and decided it's not for you. I imagine I'd also be in the same boat there. So let's get back to CPD. What was your journey and why should we not do it?
That's right. So coming out, a long-winded story. Coming out, the issue was I wanted to do everything, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So naturally, CPD quickly became a bit of fun. It was a good excuse to meet up with friends, to travel interstate, have a good time, maybe a bit of a party, and that's the way it was. So as soon as I graduated, almost weekend after weekend, I was attending CPD. And, you know, this wasn't particularly expensive CPD. Now, I say that in a guarded fashion, because I think all CPD is expensive, especially quickly you start factoring in the flights, the time off work, accommodation, food, travel, etc. And then a $500 weekend course really becomes, you know, maybe a $2,000 weekend. So, you know, I was going to course after course. It was Invisalign one weekend, and the next weekend it would be something about wisdom teeth, or it would be about restorative, and name anything under the sun. And I sort of tried it. And the funny thing was, I realized that after all of that, you know, I'd come back, and a lot of it was very high end, in the sense that you'd go 2 days and you'd see this incredible dentistry. You'd see people that have been 20 years in the field. They're doing digital smile designs. They're doing all on four treatments. They're changing people's lives. And you look at it and you say, wow, that is incredible. And in the moment, you get sucked up into it. You start learning a bit about it. You think, that's so great. This is amazing. You get so excited and passionate about your field again, which I think is really important. And then what happens is, on Monday, you come back to your practice, in my case, in regional Victoria, and you sit down in your dental chair and you go, well, wait a minute, you know, I can't actually do any of that. And I'm no closer to doing any of that than I was before I went.
For sure. You just spent $2,000 on two different tips. I've had exactly the same experience. And so you did a lot of different things, and obviously some of those things are a little bit more perhaps trying to broaden your scope. But what would you recommend a graduate does? What do you think would have been a better path?
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is having a plan. And I think I listened to your last podcast, and I think your speaker there had a similar point. It's not easy, because, you know, it's normal not to know what you want to do when you graduate. But that plan may just be to actually do a taste test of a few different things. But as long as you're doing it with some greater notion, I think that A, you'll get to where you need to be quicker, and B, you'll spend less time and money doing it, and it'll be a more enjoyable process for you. So, you know, my advice really is to go on a bit of a buffet first, if you're not sure, you know, what you want. Not in the way that I did it. Be a little bit more selective than that, because everyone comes out with at least some idea that, okay, well, this is a topic that I'm interested in, as opposed to, you know, studying dentures, knowing that maybe that's not something that you're particularly passionate about. But that's the first step, is getting a bit of a tasting menu going. And, you know, once you've done that, I think very quickly narrowing the focus is incredibly important, because unfortunately, it's easy to see these clinicians, and I suffer from this as much as anyone, see these clinicians 20 years out that are, you know, you want to say they're the jack of all trades, but really they're the master of all trades. You know, they're the Lincoln Harris of this world, and you know, many other clinicians in that same field, in that same pool. And even though some of them may even look young, it's easy to forget the path they took.
Absolutely. And it's they are essentially masters of all these disciplines, but they are the, what's the word, the red herring, or that's quite unique. You know, we to aspire to that is to aspire to be, you know, like the professional sports player. It's top of the game. And it doesn't mean we all need to be there either. You mentioned it would have been Dean Lysenblatt. We were talking about implants. He's talking about his path and what he recommends. He recommends, particularly if you're thinking about bigger stuff like implants, let's talk maybe about orthodontics, maybe full mouth, whatever, is do a tiny bit first, just to make sure you're kind of interested, but then go down a structured pathway and have a plan. And I think he made a really good point in that podcast, for sure. You've done a lot of CPD. You're also quite passionate about it. You're actually interested in kind of changing the pathway around that. And we're getting onto the general dental residency. Tell us about the general dental residency.
Yeah. So, I mean, the general dental residency, it's a project that I worked on with a friend, sort of starting mid last year. And it was really born out of this realization that along this pathway, what had happened inadvertently is we'd wasted a lot of time and money, and we were struggling to find the kind of CPD that we were after. So Alex and I, we basically wondered whether there might be a better way. a better way to connect young dentists that want to level up. Because I really feel that, coming out of dental school, and there's nothing right or wrong with this, but there are some people that see, the end of dental school as the end of their learning. And I think there are others that see it as the start. And really what we're there for is for those people that see the end of dental school as the start of their learning. Because more than anything, what we realized was missing was a bridge between this sort of cheaper weekend CPD where you'd go, you'd have fun, and you wouldn't necessarily leave with any new skills or the support and mentorship that you needed to actually implement those skills. Because for someone who's been out in the field for 10 years, they might go to this weekend course and have the confidence and maybe equipment abilities to actually go and try some of it out at least. Whereas for a new graduate, I think that there's a lot more hand-holding required, and rightly so, so that people feel confident and that they deliver the right care to their patients. But what we realized was between that sort of CPD and the very high-end stuff I'm talking about, and these are the continuums that I was considering, your $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 investment, not to mention 1, 2, 3 years of learning in order to really gain a whole new skill set. As a new graduate, I think a lot of people, they're not necessarily ready to make that step, both financially, but also from a commitment perspective, from time and energy. So I guess what we realized was we really needed something that was A, comprehensive, so similar to those longer continuums, but B was more affordable, like those weekend style CPDs, so that you would still able to be able to actually afford the education, but come out of it with some form of ongoing help and some actual ability to implement the learning. And that was the focus. That is the focus, is implementing your learning and not just going and being talked to, but having the support you need to actually then go and put it into practice. Because I'm sure you'll agree here, but I've certainly done this where even a good CPD you'll go to and then you'll leave and maybe you won't get the right case, you won't quite have the right tool, the right confidence, and you won't implement it, even though you've got the knowledge. The knowledge isn't everything.
Absolutely. It's such an important thing. And you touch on some points that are, dear to my heart. The whole point of Dental Head Start is to help you go from dental school to private practice. And what you're talking about here is exactly that, but it's that next step. It's extending yourself, and it's a difficult thing to do. It's the same. I've had the same challenges in my early CPD education, and I think what you're talking about is a really great thing. This is the vision for the future at the moment. Of course, you're starting out. You've done a few events, and how have they gone? How's things gone?
Yeah, that's right. And we've started out with the buffet, the tasting menu. That's what we've been working on first and foremost. And really what we've been doing is we've ran 3 events now. It's been a load of fun, to be honest. And my favorite part of it all really has been the education is one thing, but actually being able to be in a room full of young, like-minded people is an incredible, incredible experience. And whether it be, at an event that we've ran or at a similar event, I think that everyone has to seek out these opportunities, because there is nothing better than being surrounded by like-minded people. Because the best part of any CPD is always the people that you meet and the discussions that you have with them. And something that, and it was almost by accident that we were able to create this, but without even realizing, we'd created an environment where people would come together, and I've never heard such a loud volume in the room at a CPD event as we've had at our event, just people talking nonstop, to the point where we can't even, get the event started or start up again after a break, just because we've really been able to connect the right people, which for me is truly humbling and my absolute favorite part of all of it, really.
Yeah, that's a really great point. It's the people you meet. It's the connections. It's the support that you gain from those people. It's just as important as what you learn. And there's nothing more motivating than going to an event like that where the energy's high, and then getting back and that next week of dentistry is a lot easier.
100%.
So it sounds like you've got big plans and a journey to go on with the general dental residency. What kind of, when can we expect some of this stuff? What are you thinking with this plan?
Yeah, 100%. Like I said, you know, the focus right now really is the buffet, the tasting menu. So currently over the next 12 months, we're really trying to roll out regular events and starting to expand a little bit outside of Melbourne where we're based. You know, I think our next event at the moment, I'm not sure if we're ready to announce it just yet, but it will
here's
be
the scoop.
Here's the scoop. It will be, it's looking like it'll be in Sydney with, you know, a very, very good speaker, very well-known person, lovely guy who has actually been on your show, I believe. So there's a little teaser for you. But more than anything, being able to connect not only people with people, but actually young people with all these great younger dentists who are just doing so well and really sharing their journey across social media has been a great part, you know, just bringing out people like Bharat Agrawal, like Sahil Soni out to Melbourne has been really an honor. And it's been great to see how supporting a lot of these more experienced clinicians have been of the concept, because I think that they too realize, you know, the difficulties faced by younger dentists, which is why there's all these, you know, discussions being had that never had been when it comes to mentorship, finding your first job, and just starting your career the right way. So it's great to see the amount of people that have been willing to help. And, you know, like I said, moving forwards, we're really planning to keep that buffet menu going and really just give people a taste of what it's like to be in that room full of like-minded people.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it surely resonates with these people who they're, you know, they're excellent dentists, but they would have started out in the same way as well. So it's a really important thing. I think you guys are doing great work, Alex and yourself. Let's tie things together a little bit. I want to find out a little bit about what you've learned in this year, what your most important thing you've learned this year, or, you know, the last, let's say 2 years of seeing patients and coming to where you already are. What's the most important thing you've learned?
I think at the end of the day, what I've learned more than anything else is that it is a patient that we're treating and not a mouth, as cliche as that sounds. And the reason why I said that is because there've been lots of times when, you know, I may have, and every new graduate will do this, I've overstepped. I've decided to take on something that either, you know, perhaps beforehand I knew could be tricky, or maybe I hadn't even had the foresight to understand the potential complications. And look, I'll give you an example. You know, I'm open to discussing these things because I don't think it really breaches any confidentiality if we're not naming people. But, you know, one example is I had a patient come in and lovely older lady. She was scheduled to have some hip surgery later in the year, bilateral hip replacements. And we were trying to make her dentistry fit around that schedule. So what we did was, you know, I had a look around and her mouth was, you know, a lot of patchwork dentistry, basically. And it was time for a refresh. So, you know, I had a look around and she had an upper partial denture, okay, a cobalt chrome denture. And we made a treatment plan. You know, we talked about the ideal options with crowns and all sorts of things. And with everything going on in her life, you know, we went for a bit more of a budget-friendly option, composite. We did all the treatment. And then I very quickly realized that, you know, I was changing the shape and contour of inadvertently many of the teeth that were supporting her denture. And to this day, I don't think I've had as many adjustment appointments, you know, with one patient as I have with anyone else. And not to say that she didn't know that, you know, the outcome wouldn't be ideal given that we weren't doing custom fit crowns with a new cobalt chrome, etc. But the mistake that I made was I said to myself, you know, we'll make it work somehow. And you know, inadvertently, I led her through a series of, I think it was something like 10 adjustment appointments. And she was traveling from quite far away back and forth trying to, and no matter what I did, you know, the denture, it just didn't feel right. You know, to her, even if it was still fitting okay, it didn't feel right. And this is where I come back to the point that it's a person and not, you know, a mouth or a tooth, because, you know, I might look at this, you know, this work and say, you know, it looks reasonable, it's fitting okay. But the person, you know, everything about this is very personal. And if to them it's not right and you can't meet their expectations, then you're left in a position where you feel terrible. And, you know, there are a couple situations like that. And I think the big learning lesson for me and maybe for other people, you know, out of all of that is really to sit down and ask yourself before you do anything and ask yourself, you know, if this were my mom, you know, my dad or my sister, you know, would I be doing the same thing? And it's something that I heard another dentist, and a lot of what I say has been picked up from other dentists that I've, you know, observed or seen. It's something I heard them say, and it's something that I've actually incorporated into my language with patients is, you know, I'll be quite honest with them. I'll tell them, you know, look, if you were my mom, I wouldn't be giving you an option. I'd be saying, you know, we've got to do this or we've got to do that. And I think that that really conveys across to them the importance of, I guess, seeking out treatment that is right for them and maybe not going for those options that might not meet their expectations. And again, you know, it all comes back to the fact that, you know, you need to be happy with your work, but your patients need to be happy with it because, you know, whether you use rubber dam or not, you know, they don't know, they probably don't care. You know, it's good to take pride in your own work, but your patients have to have the confidence in you in order to actually, you know, achieve the result that you're both after. And that really comes down to treating them as a person first.
Yeah, that's such a great point. It's so true. And setting expectations as well. And that, like you've said, and you've brought this up with me before, which it's a really important thing. Setting expectations is what's going to, you know, go through the treatment together in and both be happy in the outcome. Like you said, she chose something that was a little bit more the budget option, I guess, but still good treatment. But she may have then not realized that there would have been those differences. And I've walked into that many times and learned the hard way as well. It's a really, really great point. You talk to a lot of graduates and students in, you know, in the position you're doing with the general dental residency and you're following on social media. They've just graduated. They're just starting to see their patients and all the rest of it. What would you, if you could teach them all something, what would you teach every single graduate who just finished?
Yeah, I mean, first thing first, if they're listening to podcasts, they're already 10 steps ahead of the game. And, you know, for me, I think that's really personally what evoked my passion for dentistry. And it only came about, you know, later on, third, fourth year, an absolute obsession with podcasts. And, you know, I keep saying the word dental school, which maybe for a lot of people will sound odd. And maybe you can empathize with me here. But it's because of the insane amount of American podcasts that I've listened to. So number one is you've done the right thing by listening to the amazing stuff that David does here on the Dental Head Start, because I think there's, you know, no one better in Australia that is connecting with, you know, the younger audiences and putting out such great content that really throws light onto what has really been, you know, in the darkness for a very long time, which is what happens when you leave dental school. You know, I certainly didn't know. I had no idea. So that's really step number one. And, you know, one thing I try and I'm a big advocate of teaching being the best way to learn, which is why as soon as I finished dental school, I pestered my university, La Trobe University. I was emailing the dean there probably every month after finishing, saying, oh, you know, can I come in? Can I help out? Can I do something? And I ended up kind of helping out with some of the second year students in the pre-clinic this year. And what I always tell them and try and convey more than anything is a sense of pride in your work. So I think that two things, if you have an obsession with learning and, you know, podcasts, I'm not talking about textbooks. Textbooks are great. And even though I was a bad student at the start, by the end, I was pretty, you know, book smart. But you know, textbooks are great. But when I say learning, I mean real world learning. And, you know, here's a little hint, and I openly tell the second years this, but your grades don't really matter. But I didn't say that because I'm not sure if I can say that as a tutor at the university. But what's important is that you get exposed early on to what real life dentistry is. So that's number one. Now, for me, and this is what I tell all of them, I say exactly what you did, David, go and be a dental assistant. There was nothing better for me than when I took a job at a temporary staffing agency where I would rock up and just do a day of work. And it was a lot of pressure with people expecting you to integrate into their team all of a sudden. But seeing 30 plus clinicians and the different ways they work, the way they explain things to patients always fascinated me. Because no one person explains the same procedure the same way. So get exposed, get out there, ask to observe. I think that in general, the dental community is very open, very warm. So if you do put yourself out there, you will receive. You will have those opportunities, but you have to create them for yourself. So put yourself out there, have a big passion, a big thirst for learning, ask the right questions, ask lots of them, and take pride in your work. And you're going to go very, very, very far.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great advice. That's so funny. I actually did temp agency job in Brisbane or Queensland, and then I got a job like straight out of it. So I only did one person. And then in Sydney, I only did one person as well. But that's a great point. If you actually can get yourself in many different dental assisting roles, and I ended up doing like three or four, five maybe, you hear different ways people explain things and you see procedures done differently as well, and you learn so much from that. That's fantastic stuff. I was like laughing so hard when you're talking about American podcasts. Obviously, I'm obsessed with podcasts and was because I've started one, but I say dental school and everyone probably thinks I'm a bit strange because of it, and I'm not American. I've just listened to way too much. I actually wrote to one of the American dental podcasts, and I emailed and said something about university, and he wrote back straight away and said, "You must be from Australia." And it's funny because then I've evolved into saying dental school because dental university is just strange.
Yeah, which podcast was that? Out of curiosity,
that was Dental Hacks. Alan Mead, he's a good guy.
Okay, classic, great guy.
Great podcast. Guy. Yeah, the pioneer.
Big fan.
We've got a little bit sidetracked, but Dan Marianowski, I appreciate so much your time here on the Dental Head Start podcast. Thank you for sharing with everybody out there listening.
Yeah, look, it was absolutely my honor. And, you know, it's always great talking to like-minded people. So I think that, you know, we had a really great chat, and I'm really grateful for you inviting me on here. And I think what you're doing is incredible. So all I can say is keep up the amazing work, and I'm going to keep listening religiously. In fact, I do believe that I was the first listener to your latest output. So
I will
claim that trophy.
Well, if you subscribe, you'll try and beat Dan to it. Dan, you had plenty to give. It's been an hour and 15 minutes. Thank you again. Have a good night.
Thank you.
You're a student, you're a graduate, and you're looking for the perfect course. I imagine that course, it's going to have passionate, world-renowned speakers. It's going to have tips and techniques that you can implement immediately in your practice. It's going to be in a great place over, say, 2 days so that you can party with your mates that night. You can make a trip out of it if you're traveling. It's going to have some great food and, of course, it's going to have some free drinks. Well, that sounds really good, but I imagine that would be pretty expensive. But it's not. That meeting is actually the Midwinter Meeting by Restoring Excellence held in Sydney this year. That's on June 26th and 27th, and of course, it's with Dr. Lincoln Harris. For students, it costs just $79. I don't imagine that would cover the free beer, let alone the food, the speakers, the venue. So it is very generous of them to put this on. If you're a dentist, it costs $250. That is still at least a tenth of what it's worth. I have no doubt this is going to be a fantastic event for students and graduates. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. If you're interested, register at the link in the show notes or find it on the Restoring Excellence homepage. It's easy for us to look at people's work on Instagram and think that they're something out of the ordinary. It's really great to talk with Dan and to find out that he's a genuine, nice guy. It was a great chat, and I hope you got a lot out of that. We didn't get to touch on this, but an interesting fact about Dan is he thinks it's important to have a life outside of teeth, and something he loves doing is ballroom dancing. I wish I got to ask him more about his experience there. Maybe you could reach out to him and strike up a conversation. Check out what they're doing at General Dental Residency on Instagram. Now, have you ever heard someone say, "I hate the dentist"? I think we all hear it. We hear it most days. And in the Prime Head Start segment today, we've got the opportunity to talk with Brett Chernin about this and how we should frame this in our mind and how we should deal with it. But I also want to say something really important. This, for the next 2 weeks, if you're listening to this when it's released, there is a huge discount given by Prime Practice for their Prime Speak course. And now this is for students and graduates. You can get 60% off. That's over $1,700 off the course, off the cost of the course. And I can't recommend enough learning about communication early in your career. So if you're interested in that, that's even better than what you can get through us. If you're listening to this later on, there's 50% off for graduates and students at dentalheadstart.com/primeheadstart. Also, if you're not a graduate, you can get 40% off their entire range of courses. So I think this is huge. It's only for a couple of weeks over ADX. Go and snap it up and get some great education. So welcome to the Prime Head Start segment, proudly brought to you by Prime Practice. Today, we have the pleasure of chatting with Brett Chernin. And Brett's been with Prime Practice for a long time. He's a familiar face. We actually have an interview coming up, which I'm excited about. But for today, we have a specific question that I think everyone has heard before, in fact, perhaps daily. Our patients come in, the first thing they say is, I hate the dentist. How are we supposed to manage that, cope with that, and respond to that?
It's a big one because it's one of my favorite questions that, you know, that I'll ask the participants at the Prime Speak seminar is like, how often do you hear that? You know, and almost everyone will say, well, at least every day, if not multiple times a day. And, you know, I've always been really curious about when, if you heard that multiple times every day, like what impact does it have? And I joke to participants, I'm like, gosh, I don't know what it would be like if every time I ran, you know, this thing that I was passionate about, this seminar, you know, practice owners workshop or Prime Speak, and as I greeted people in the workshop, they'd say, oh God, I hate coming to these workshops. You know, like what would it do to me? You know, how would it make me feel about something that I'm passionate about, that I love doing and that I know that makes a difference? And so I guess that's, I'd really love, and I invite dentists to almost reflect in the same way, as in, what is the impact on you as a dentist when you hear that multiple times in a day? And now, how have you started to respond to it? What's your immediate knee-jerk reaction to that, knowing that it's going to come? You know, because sometimes what happens is we hear it so many times that we end up creating some kind of, you know, rehearsed response to it almost subconsciously, you know, without thinking about, and this is the really important point, without thinking about where is that statement coming from?
Yeah.
From the patient's world, from the patient's perspective. Mm-hmm. Because often the patient will say to the dentist, you know, oh, it's nothing personal. I just, you know, it's like, well, yeah. Thanks,
oh,
you know.
No,
like,
no offense.
And, the, you know, and the thing is, I don't know of many profession where the people who are in the profession are passionate about doing good and making a difference to the client or the customer base, and yet, or the receivers of their service, and yet the receivers themselves have so many emotions associated with coming to see that person. There's not many professions where that occurs. So given that it's unique, a unique situation requires unique, not just responses, but unique mm-hmm. capacity to manage that. And really at the end of the day, that comes down more so to a dentist's ability to manage their own internal response to hearing that and then being able to then deal with that, and then because if they can manage their own response, then they can manage whatever is going on in the world of the patient, which is ultimately what the patient really wants. They just want to be heard and listened to, and maybe it was a really terrible experience they've had in the past. Maybe there's just like a lot of fear there, or, you know, like, who knows? But if you just come in with...
There's always something underneath.
There's always something, especially the angry ones. You know, almost always underneath the anger is fear. And underneath the fear, there's a past experience or some kind of belief or mindset that if you as the dentist don't deal with now, I can promise you it's going to come and bite you on the bum later anyway. So you might as well deal with that resistance and that whatever's going on with the patient now, because if you have to deal with it later on when you're trying to present, you know, options, it's going to come up later. It'll come up in the decision-making process. So why not deal with it right in the beginning?
Then the patient knows that they're heard as well.
Oh, totally.
Instead of just being glossed over, they're saying it for a reason. They're reaching out.
Yeah, absolutely. And they want to be heard and they want to know that you understand their experience and that you're aligned with them and that you're not going to repeat whatever was done to them before, or that, you know, they want to know that you care about them. You know, and them feeling heard and listened to, you know, telling you the story about the dentist who put his knee on their chest when they were a kid, or, you know, like they'll have all those sort of some sort of stories. And if you just say, oh, don't worry, it won't hurt, you're jumping into an assumption that it's all about pain, and it could be about something completely different.
Absolutely. So how do you suggest we consider this, and how do you suggest we respond to this?
Look, you got each dentist has to find their own wording around it. So, like, you know, as we say in prime speak, there's no script around it. But I think I'd start with the knee-jerk reaction is always empathy. Mm-hmm. So if a dentist can be, you know, can demonstrate empathy with something like, look, I can really understand that, you know, that'll make a difference, some version of that. And then back that up with the fact that actually, like, you're not alone. You know, I hear it often. It's a very common thing. So they know that they're not alone. And then what we call click down in prime speak, which is really just inquiring and finding out a little bit more about why they hate coming to the dentist is the real gold. It's like, you know, for everybody, it's often a different thing. Some people hate coming to the dentist because they've had a bad experience. Some people hate coming to the dentist because there's a lot of uncertainty of like what's going on inside your head, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what makes you say that you hate coming to the dentist. It would really help me to help you if I knew.
Exactly. If we know, we can hopefully avoid that and we can have a better relationship, and that's exactly what we want and what the patient wants. That's
totally
perfect.
Totally.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us today, Brett. All right. I hate the dentist. It's an opportunity for us to understand more about that patient. And I think that's a great way to frame it. Thank you, Brett, so much. As always, thank you to all of our sponsors and all of the listeners. We're able now to make an impact. We're giving in partnership with B1G1. Check that out at dentalheadstart.com/giving. Every listen gives water to a family, a person who needs it in a developing nation. And every share gives oral hygiene to someone as well. Reach out with your comments and feedback on Facebook at Dental Head Start, and check out cpdjunkie.com.au. For now, we'll catch you next episode.